for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. Tonight, we head to Michigan, where President Joe Biden took 81% of the votes in Tuesday's Democratic primary. But more than 100,000 people opted for uncommitted, seen as a protest against the White House's stance on the war in Gaza, in a state with the biggest Arab American population in the country. In one of the few certified swing states in the upcoming November election, what impact could that backlash against Biden have on his chances in Michigan and overall? He is best known for his biting political satire, but on Monday, comedian, author, and Daily Show host Jon Stewart closed out the show with a very heartfelt, touching, and personal story about the death of his dog, Dipper. It's resonated with people right across the continent, and we look into the process of grieving the loss of a pet and hear from someone who helps those working through that kind of loss. And on this Leap Day Eve, we look back at probably the biggest political event in Canadian history on February 29th. It was 40 years ago tomorrow, 1984, when the term walk in the snow became synonymous with any politician heading for the exits, as then Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau announced that he was leaving politics. But just how spontaneous was it really? And is there any possibility that his son may follow in those snowy footsteps in 2024? And we look into the history of February 29th, how it came to be and why the Romans decided that February was the right month to stick it into, and discover what it's like to be a leap day baby with someone who celebrates a birthday on that rarest of birthdays. And again, we do mark a bit of a rarity tomorrow, needless to say, as far as our calendar goes. 2024 is a leap year. I'm sure you're well aware of this by now. So we get a 29th of February. This happens nearly, but not every 4 years. The Gregorian calendar, which is used in most countries in the world, will get an extra day tomorrow. But why? Where did it originate? And if you pull the threads on the history of leap year, you wind up going as far back as Roman Emperor Julius Caesar, and the cold, hard reality that it takes the Earth more than 365 days to revolve around the sun. And it can wreak havoc on a calendar if left unchecked. But why did it end up in February? Why do we rarely but occasionally skip a leap year? The next time that's going to happen is 76 years from now in 2100. Alexander Boxer knows this stuff inside out. He's a data scientist. His book is called A Scheme of Heaven, The History of Astrology and the Search for Our Destiny in Data. And he joins me now as we get set to mark a February 29th. Alexander, thanks for your time tonight.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I saw you describe February 29th as an awkward calendar hack, and I thought that was a really interesting way of putting it because I'd never seen it put that way. Why is that?
Well, there's no question that we have a strange calendar, and it's simply, how do you feel about having a strange calendar? I love our calendar, and I love February 29th because it is sort of this weird hack or a seam that if you start pulling the thread, tells this incredible story of how we got here and a story of how we measure time, a story of how different civilizations have all built upon each other to build the calendar that we have. But the simple answer is we have this strange thing called leap year because the Earth's orbit around the sun does not fall into a perfect number of even days. We don't have a nice 365-day year. It's 365 and a little bit extra. And that little bit extra, there's a long story to it, but that little bit extra is why we have leap day.
Right. And this is just an attempt to try to make sure that that doesn't spiral out of control over time.
Right. And it certainly has in the past. And so we don't have to imagine too much what it would be like to not have a leap day. Many calendars in the past, most famously the Egyptian calendar, had a very nice 365 days. And astronomers, both in ancient times and also even more recent times in the scientific revolution, still use that calendar because it's very easy to know how many days went from one observation to the next. Or if you wanted to know how long it had been from something you did last year to this year, it's easy to figure it out. You don't have to ask yourself or scratch your head how many leap years came in between. But the downside to that was that we have a leap year approximately once every 4 years. That's because the excess is about a quarter of a day, a little bit less. We can talk about that. That means that every 4 years, the calendar is going to slip by basically a day. If you live to 80 years, typical human lifespan, you would see certain holidays already slip by 20 days. So very quickly, winter holidays start happening in the fall, then the summer, then the spring. everything gets out of whack.
You mentioned earlier about pulling the threads on the history of leap year, and you start to see some familiar names, Julius Caesar, Pope Gregory. There's some names start to pop up. You're like, how are they involved in all this?
Right. So I don't know. Certainly Julius Caesar is a more familiar name than Pope Gregory the 13th.
Yes.
They're both important characters, but I think it's rare in the history of science that you can really attribute a major change to one person. But in this case, we can. Julius Caesar is the main character of this story. He took the ancient Roman calendar, which I think is got to win the award for worst calendar, successful in almost none of the things it tried to do. Just an absolutely mind-bendingly bad, complicated calendar. And he said, we need to do something better. He chose the system that we basically have today of the months that we know, with the lengths of days that we know, January, February, March, April, May, and a leap year every 4 years. Now, as your savvy listeners will know, because of what happened in the Renaissance, we do not have a leap year exactly every 4 years. We have to throw a couple of them out, but essentially the calendar we have today is the calendar that was invented by Julius Caesar.
And then it's refined, right? It's somewhat refined.
Correct. So think about it. We started with what we call the Egyptian calendar, which was 365 days. Egyptians were savvy astronomers. The Greeks in Alexandria living in Egypt were savvy astronomers. They knew that that was not the length of the tropical year, the sol year. So what do we mean? We mean is you could actually do this. If you sat out in your backyard every day and measured how high the sun was every day when it passed due south, you'd take that measurement and say, how many days does it take to get to the same elevation? You realize it wasn't quite 365 days. 365, about a quarter. It's actually more like 365.242. Now, you take Julius Caesar's calendar, because it had one leap year every 4 years, that meant that the average year was 365 and a quarter days. Mm-hmm. Pretty good. It turns out that that's about 11 minutes too long. 11 minutes, pretty good.
Pretty good, but it adds up. It adds up over time.
Up. Yeah. And so after about 1,500 years, people realized that this calendar was starting to get out of alignment again. In particular, it was throwing a lot of trouble for the computation of Easter. This became a topic of much dispute. Finally, you know, calendars are fundamentally political. You needed somebody to say, all right, the astronomers know what's going on, but we need a calendar. And that was Pope Gregory the 13th in 1582, changed the calendar once again. So remember, I said that the Julian calendar, the average year, is about 11 minutes too long. Well, okay, how do we make the average year shorter? Well, instead of having one leap year every 4 years, or in other words, instead of having 100 leap years every 400 years, they said it would be much better if we had 97 leap years every 400 years. So let's choose three leap years and throw them out. Let's make them not leap years. And that is the calendar we currently have. It is still too long. It's still too long by about 30 seconds. So
just how did it end up in February? Why did we decide to tack on an extra day in February?
Again, we can thank the Romans. We can thank Julius Caesar. They threw it into February because for them, February was sort of a rump month. Their calendar, their original calendar, started in March, which is why, if you think about it, December is for them the 10th month.
And right, Deca, of course, yeah.
And not the 12th month. They also had a new year in January too, but the original calendar started in March. February was always sort of a rump month. It was also, to the ancient Romans, an unlucky month. Romans were extremely superstitious about, well, pretty much everything, but oddly enough, maybe evenly enough, they hated even numbers. Even numbers were supremely unlucky. So all of the months had odd numbers, but they wanted the year to have an odd number of days too. So they said, okay, well, we can't do that with all odd numbers. So February was the unlucky month. It had 28 days. What I think is interesting though, is that the original leap day was not February 29th.
Right.
But what would be February 24th.
Alexander Boxer is a data scientist and author of A Scheme of Heaven, The History of Astrology and the Search for Our Destiny in Data. We're talking about leap year or leap day, which comes up, of course, tomorrow, the 29th of February, every 4 years to make up for a bit of an imperfection in our calendar in that this takes the Earth longer than 365 days to orbit the Earth. So we try to make up for that by adding an extra day every 4 years so that the whole calendar doesn't get out of whack, or at least the way the calendar reflects the seasons we're in or the times we're in doesn't get all out of whack. Alexandra, there are alternative calendars that have been proposed. We can't even agree on when and on not turning, you know, not changing the clocks back and forth each year. So I don't know how we would ever agree on a new calendar. But there are talks of, there is sort of things, alternative calendars. A permanent calendar, I think, was the one that I'd seen mentioned.
Yeah, so these calendars are fascinating. Of course, you don't have to have speculative calendars either. There's, of course, liturgical calendars, the Jewish liturgical calendar, the Islamic calendar. These calendars are used every day just fine.
Right.
Now, should we change our civil calendar? I would, of course, argue that we should not. Again, a calendar can do several things well, but you can't do all of them at the same time. And you have to make a choice based on your priority. So when people talk about these permanent calendars, they're referring to a series of calendars that have been proposed that would have the same day of the month always happen on the same year.
Right. So if your birthday was on a Tuesday, it'll be forever on a Tuesday.
Right. Yes. Now, this calendar still requires leap days. Now, they are leap. They would insert an entire leap week to make sure that the count of weeks is the same. So in a sense, is your goal to not have confusing leap years and have to scratch your head about it, whether there was a leap week in that year or not? No, it doesn't succeed on that point. It would be the same sort of confusion of, gosh, I have to know if this is a leap year or not a leap year. So if you were an astronomer and cared about a nice continuous count of days, you would say, well, this calendar is no better than what we have. Now, I also think it's interesting that you learn so much about a society by its calendar. We have this calendar, which is the product of all this history. And you look at the permanent calendar. The permanent calendar, the best I can tell, is motivated by accountant.
Right.
We just want to have an easy billing cycle. And I think it says something a little bit sad about one society if you arrange the calendar entirely based on corporate HR departments.
Yeah, the Esperanto of calendars. No offense to Esperanto.
if your birthday's on a Wednesday, maybe I'd like it to be on a Thursday next year. Why does my birthday always have to be on a Wednesday? And of course, Halloween would be right out because there's no October 31st. You know, I guess we could move a Halloween to the 30th, but...
And no Friday the 13th either. But that would go away, right? Ostensibly, that would go away.
Unless there was a month, I guess I'd have to check. Maybe in one of their months,
right,
it would always be Friday the 13th.
I think what's so interesting about the 29th of February is that it makes us reflect on something that I don't think we often reflect on, and that's the calendar that we use. It's kind of a primordial part of our lives. We deal with it every single day. It dictates so much of how we live our lives in many ways, paying bills, getting paid, going away, birthdays, anniversaries, etc. But we don't often give it much thought. And here it is, you know, more than 2,000 years old at this point, and we're still abiding by it, or about 2,000 years old.
Again, it's one reason I love leap days. I love February 29th because it's an opportunity, exactly as you say. We get to think about it and say, how did this happen? And it's really an incredible story in the history of science, and it really unravels all of it. You get Egyptians, Romans, Greeks, the medieval world, the Catholic Church, Easter, modern astronomical computations. It's all there if you are willing to pull the thread on February 29th.
Yeah. And I just can't imagine we would ever agree upon building one today if we had to, which makes it even all the more incredible.
Right. You'd probably need a pretty tyrannical regime. You'd probably need a dictator for life, a bit like Julius Caesar, to have a true new civil calendar.
And Alexander, thanks so much for your time and your insight on this. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's a pretty eclectic mix of voices, right? We had Dinah Shore into the break, then Ja Rule out of the break, Tony Robbins, Dennis Farina. You can only imagine what they all have in common. They were all born on February the 29th. That's right. Ja Rule, Tony Robbins, Dennis Farina, the late actor, and of course, Dinah Shore. For those celebrating their birthdays on the 29th, it's of course considered the rarest birthday a person can have. That kind of goes without saying. Your chances of being born on the 29th of February apparently are roughly 1 in 1,461. So it is odds. I saw an estimate somewhere that there are approximately 5 million people worldwide born on February the 29th. So not entirely uncommon, but certainly a rarity. I don't think I've ever met anyone or spent a lot of time with anyone who was born on February the 29th. And yet, you know, leap day babies usually celebrate their birthdays, I guess, on February 28th or March the 1st. Their identifications and important documents continue to list February 29th as their birth date. There's a cruise going on I was reading about today, this cruise that a gentleman from Saskatchewan is on, that is all leap year or leap day babies or leap day people on the same cruise together for a big birthday bash in the Bahamas. We wanted to know, what is it like to grow up with your birthday on February 29th. And joining me is one of them, Renee Nicole Gray. She's a fashion historian and a leap day baby. Renee, thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
This is one of those things, obviously. I'm going to try not to ask you all the bad questions you get asked all the time. But I was surprised to learn that when you were born, your mom was given the option of sort of saying, well, you could choose February 28th or March the 1st if you want, but she didn't.
Yeah, apparently that happens to a lot of women because they just think, well, maybe it's going to be too hard for them to have this birthday and their life will be easier if you just say it's the 28th instead.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, the way you write about it, perhaps not for the early years, but for most of your life, you've always been really thankful that your mom made that choice.
I have been, and I feel like it almost subconsciously paved this creative path for my life because I always felt so different, and it made me want to go into the arts and just kind of express myself because you're instantly set apart from everyone else in the world at that point. Yeah. And you feel it already.
You do, right? I mean, it must be interesting. I didn't go to school, as far as I know, with anyone who was born on February the 29th. But I mean, you write about it, that it was difficult when you're young because you're trying to sort of fit in when you're a kid and birthdays are such a big deal. And all of a sudden you have this different birthday.
Yeah, and I never got the cupcake in school.
Right, that was a sad part of it.
In elementary school, they make the list of everyone's birthday for the month, and I was always left off, accidentally, I'm sure, but you know, it wasn't there, and I didn't get the birthday cupcake, and so my mom would have to call and say, you didn't give her cupcake, and then, you know, always it came on March 1st, and we're sorry.
We're sorry. Yeah, I guess that part. What about just with the other kids and so on? Because kids can be mean, right?
Yeah, you get made fun of a little bit, or, you know, on your fake birthday, I guess you could call it, which is you choose between the 28th or March 1st, really. So some leap day babies are strict Februarians where we only celebrate the 28th and some people are only March 1st and some people do both. But I always did the 28th because I felt like I was born in February, so I want to celebrate in February.
I don't think I'd ever heard the term Februarian before. That's great.
Yeah. So yeah, but they did make fun of me a little bit on my fake birthday.
Yeah. As you get older, though, it must be such an interesting topic of conversation, even when you're a teen and when you get to university and so on. I mean, it must be really something. It's something to talk about, right?
It is. And, you know, I've had a guy once hit on me in a bar by telling me I was born on leap day. And I said, I can't say what I said on the radio, but I said, show me your ID. I don't believe you.
And?
Did not go well for him. He was not born on leap day.
But did you show him your ID as well?
Yeah. And I think he was shocked because I'm sure he's tried that a million times on other women, you know?
Jeez. Wow. Well, are there hassles when it comes? I mean, I have a name with an apostrophe in it and a hyphen in the family name, and I get run into all kinds of trouble online when I'm trying to register for stuff and so on. Is February 29th difficult when it comes to just the automated world we live in now?
It is. Driver's licenses sometimes don't pick up the 29th. So I had a license be good for 9 years because it was supposed to expire after 5, I think, and they just put it for 9 years. And also when you're entering your birthday on websites where you have that scroll thing, you know, you can't put in February 28th until you put in 19, whatever, when you're born. Right. You have to do the year first or else it just shoots you back to, like, you know, the date and it makes you put 28th.
So that can run into issues as well. What about some of the hidden benefits then of having a leap day birthday?
Like I said, I think it's really exciting and you feel very special and just different. It's exciting to wait 4 years to have a real birthday on the calendar. And you kind of just look at it the whole month in disbelief, like, it's here and I've been waiting 4 years. What do I do? Like, you almost feel like you can't ever do anything special enough to live up to the day because it's so rare, you know?
Yeah. You mentioned that as a kid, that was one of the hardest parts, was that there were years, of course, where your birthday wasn't on that calendar. And that could be confusing when you're young.
It is confusing to kids. And I know that they make kids books now about being born on leap day to kind of help explain it to them. So it's interesting.
Are you surprised that there are parents who sort of have a lot of trepidation about having a kid on the 29th, that they try to sort of, you know, that they try to avoid it just because they think it's going to be an issue for their child?
I think there are people that would say no thanks. But I mean, for me, like I said, I wouldn't trade it for the world. I think it's such a cool birthday, and it's always a great topic of conversation. People just go, oh my God, so you're three. That's all you hear is you're 3 years old. It doesn't matter how old you are, really. I'm having my 10th real birthday now. So it's like, nope, I'm not three. You can do the math, but I get it. And you kind of have to laugh and like fake laugh at it because you've heard it a million times in your life, right?
I was
like,
I wanted to know, I guess, because you've written about this. I wanted to know what are the questions that are the most annoying for someone born on the 29th?
So what? Yeah, that one. What are you, three?
Yeah. Always three, right? It's always three.
Oh, always three. When do you celebrate? Or they say you're not allowed to celebrate until March 1st because you're not actually older yet.
Well, I guess. I don't know. That's one of those like, existential questions, isn't it?
I guess there's a little millisecond there maybe. And I kind of go, oop, there's my second. And it drifts away every
good.
4 years. So celebrate that 1 second in between.
Well, I mean, I have to say, Lordy, 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 look who's 10 is better than the alternative with the cards I was getting a decade ago. Yeah.
It's a big one this year for me. So I'm ooh, it's the biggest one. And I actually, you don't have a milestone birthday like this very often. I think the next one I'll be 60. So
wow, of course, of course. Oh, I hadn't even thought of that. I guess that's one of the, I mean, it doesn't change. Well, how would you know if your birthday is on the 29th and you don't have any other birthday, but it mustn't change the way, I wonder if it changes the way you think about age.
A little bit. I think I appreciate birthdays a lot more, I would say, being this is only my 10th one of my whole entire life.
Right.
But it does sort of make you feel a little younger, and you think I'm young at heart, or I'm forever young, I guess, should be a little cheesy, you know?
Well, it's a good, I mean, there's many a song title called Forever Young. So, I mean, tomorrow's the big day. What do you have planned? I know you just said that almost nothing can live up to the sort of anticipation of a birthday every 4 years. It's kind of like, you know, the Olympics, but what do you have planned?
We're just having a really special party at my house, low-key, and all of my favorite things. The last one, we went to Paris, so I feel like nothing can live up to that one. But it's going to be special and just kind of intimate, and
Yeah, well, listen, let me be one of the first to wish you a very, very happy birthday, Renee. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So here's an interesting question for you. Is tomorrow, since it's an extra day in the year, the 366th day of 2024, not yet, but you know what I mean? There will be 366 days. Are you working tomorrow for free? Think about it. If normally your annual salary covers 365, if you add that extra day, February 29th, is it a freebie for your employer? Here's Brittany Taylor. She's an employment lawyer talking about this.
This is obviously not the first time we've had a leap year, but I feel like this is one of the first times that we've seen a lot of interest around this topic and the question of, am I working for free on the 29th?
So are you? Well, it all depends. Rafael Gomez is a professor and director of the Center for Industrial Relations and Human Resources at the University of Toronto. Rafael, thanks for your time tonight.
Thanks, Ben.
Tell me a bit about, she's right. I don't think I'd ever seen this discussed in the context of a leap year before. And all of a sudden, this year we are. Why do you think? Is that just the media jumping on something? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I mean, it causes, I think the deeper question is, why are we talking about this? I think if you center in on like I said, that's why you had me on. So, I think if you center on the question of who this affects, you actually mentioned it, you bracketed a salaried employee. If you're an hourly or a daily wage earner, this isn't an issue, right? It's an extra day and you'll be paid for that day or for the hours worked on that day. So this is really occurring amongst people whose work is kind of more guaranteed, if you will, during the year. We tend to think of salaried employees as being kind of more privileged. You know, they tend to have better job security than an hourly or wage earner, better benefits, pensions, and these sorts of things. And yet they're the ones that seemingly are kind of raising these questions. Obviously, that employment lawyer is fielding calls. You know, I don't think this is an issue that's been, quote unquote, drummed up by media. I think the media is responding to signals that this is out there in the zeitgeist.
Yeah, I wonder what's changed. I mean, I get that someone who works, you know, gets paid an annual salary. It's just an interesting question. You think, you're right, there is right. an extra day this year. Am I getting paid for it? And the answer is, well, no, probably not.
No. Yeah. And so I think if you go back, I think this is a consequence of a number of forces, right? And I think the most proximate causes are what's basically we've lived with for the last few years. Think about the pandemic and think about who was called essential during the pandemic. Well, actually, those were the workers that traditionally we didn't think had such great jobs, you know, cashiers, people working in warehouses, delivery workers. They were certainly paid for every day they worked and every hour. And we also attached a name to those workers, essential. They were called essential. Now, that's fine. And I think that was probably right. It was correct. But you know what category you've created by default? An unessential worker. And guess who was unessential then? People on salaries who actually couldn't go to work. Their offices were shuttered. I bet your office, you probably had to do all your recording from home studios and such. So we created kind of a category, inadvertently perhaps, of these unessential salaried workers who then, when the lights were turned back on and said, let's get back to work, nothing was ever kind of, I think, quite set back in the way it was. And I think this has lingered in people's mind. Was my work that unessential that you could turn it off and on? And there were people that, far worse, they had their jobs completely shut, right? Think about theater, actors, their whole professions right. were done. So I think if we've returned back, and this is now, you know, we're 2 years on from perhaps the end of most of those lockdowns and restrictions, I think psychologically, we haven't dealt with it. So now the first leap year after the pandemic, because 2020, February was the last one, why this issue right. has popped up. So that caused me to think, because there was like nothing else has changed so much as there are a few lingering forces. Like actually, we have more salaried workers today than we had wage earners, say, 30 years ago. But that wouldn't explain this sort of pop up in the interest right now. I think it really links to things that happened during the pandemic. The other thing, of course, is the cost of living. Things are way more expensive right. now than 4 years ago. So my every day of pay kind of matters more now.
Yeah. Someone just texted in to point out quite correctly that if you pay rent, you're getting an extra day of rent for free. So, I mean, I wonder when it is true. I guess some of our, yeah. but you know, if you look at this from the employer's perspective, then, I mean, I think it all comes out in the wash, right? In the long run, mm-hmm. the one day is not such mm-hmm. a big deal. But if you look at it from the employer's perspective, are they getting a free day? I guess perhaps they are.
Well, yeah. I mean, if we focus on the narrow question, like is the issue really about this day or is it about something right. deeper? Like, are we getting our fair compensation and compensation here's broadly defined or an air quote? How are we being compensated by our employers? Are we being treated fairly? Have we really recovered from what happened during the pandemic? And is my employer now forcing me to come, you know, after telling me to be at home, then forcing me to come back for 5 days a week? This is all very, you know, I think caused a lot of disruption in people's lives. And if an employer isn't cognizant of those issues, then it'll pop up in this very, you know, particular instance that the employees will be kind of haranguing or demanding. And you're right, in the wash, it's not huge, but it's a symbolic issue that probably speaks to deeper concerns in some employment context.
A little more tension in 2024 right. on leap year between That's employer right. and employee than there was back in 2020.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I was watching a report earlier today that did suggest that for those who are paid minimum wage, if you work mm-hmm. an extra day and that dips you below mm-hmm. your minimum wage average for the year, there could be, you could actually go seek compensation for it. I don't know if it's worth it, but you could.
I see. Right. Because the salary itself is predicated on a set number of hours. Now you're working more hours, which then drops
right.
you. Yeah. I mean, and again, we may think that doesn't matter, but if someone, again, dealing with the cost of living crisis and who's earning right at that razor's edge, then it doesn't matter. It is materially important to you now that costs have gone up 30%. You know, that's how high inflation has been over these last few years. We're literally paying 30% more than we did in 2020 for essential goods, food, housing.
Yeah.
So I don't think this is a kind of a trivial matter, actually.
No wonder we're a little less generous with this free day. That's more this free day coming up tomorrow. Yeah. Raphael, thank you so much for your insight on this. It was interesting. I hadn't really thought of it as being a much more profound industrial relations issue than simply sort of people talking about the novelty of it. So there you have it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having me on.
And imagine that 40 years ago tomorrow, perhaps the most significant political event ever on a leap day in this country, February 29th, 1984, when the term walk in the snow became part of our political lexicon, synonymous with any politician heading for the exits. Here is then Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau explaining his decision to permanently retire from politics on February 29th, 1984.
I went to judo with my boys. Very good. Judo lesson because nobody was there because of the storm, so we had to teach it all to ourselves. And I went home, discussed with the boys, put them to bed, walked till midnight in the storm. Interesting, eh? And then I went home and took a sauna for even an hour and a half. It was all clear. I was gonna leave, but I went to sleep just in case I'd change my mind overnight, and I didn't. I woke up. It was great. I used the old cliche, this is the first day of the rest of my life.
There he is, then Prime Minister, the late Pierre Elliott Trudeau, on February 29th, 1984, explaining why he had made the decision to resign in the famous walk in the snow, which, if you believe that story word for word, would have been happening exactly 40 years ago now. He said he was walking until midnight. It's now 11:06 p.m. In Ottawa. There's no snow there now. So if you're thinking about his son, he mentions his boys. One of them, of course, is now Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. If you're thinking that another Trudeau will be taking a walk in the snow, well, there's no snow. So that right there, the parallels are out. But we will be talking about that in just a bit. I mean, of course, what happened on 40 years ago tomorrow sort of wound up a remarkable run in Canadian politics. Pierre Trudeau served as prime minister for 15 years and 164 days between 1968 and 1984. That is the third longest in history behind King and MacDonald. He won three majorities, served in one minority government, lost an election, of course, famously to Joe Clark back in 1979, then came back and won again. The idea that he was sort of a rebel, kind of a counterculture figure in the 60s and the 70s. We don't have to go into the whole history of Pierre Elliott Trudeau. Most of you out there will know it and have your opinions about it already. But the idea that somehow everything he did was spontaneous was also a bit of a myth. The famous pirouette in front of Princess Margaret in 1977 at Buckingham Palace. Apparently he knew where the cameras were. The decision to retire on February 29th, maybe not as spontaneous as you might imagine. He did have a flair for the dramatic. Someone who knows all about this is Raymond Blake. He's a professor in the Department of History at the University of Regina. He's a fellow at the Royal Society of Canada. And he's the author of an upcoming book called Canada's Prime Ministers and the Shaping of a National Identity. Of course, Pierre Elliott Trudeau did a lot on that front as well. Raymond, thanks for your time tonight.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Well, it's hard to think that 40 years ago, I can't believe it's been 40 years since that infamous walk in the snow, but here we are. What a very big day, perhaps the biggest day, the biggest leap day in Canadian political history was 40 years ago tomorrow.
Well, it was. And, as you had already said, Mr. Trudeau did very little that we sort of expected, but yet he had planned so many things. And it's so fitting for him to retire, on a day that comes around once every 4 years.
Yeah, and you sort of posit that this probably wasn't, or I think the evidence points to it, that this wasn't as spontaneous as he liked. The whole idea of walking in the snow, maybe that was entirely true, but the whole idea that that's what he came up with his decision was probably a little bit of a stretch.
Well, I think absolutely. But, he sounds in that little clip that you played there, he sounds so convincing. And it really plays into the mystery, the mystique of the man. And he had said when he came, even he was resurrected in 1980. He had resigned in 1979 after he lost to Mr. Clark, drove off in his fancy Mercedes sports car and, you know, wave goodbye, and they're said to the press, you won't have me to kick around anymore. And lo and behold, you know, Joe Clark's government falls, and the Liberals are the leader. And what do? They call on Pierre Trudeau yet again. And he comes back and doesn't win a seat, you know, where you are, where I am, west of Manitoba, but he wins a majority, you know, resurrected from the dead. And this is sort of really amazing. And he comes back and he says, in his first opening remark after winning the May election, he says, "Welcome to the 80s." And Pierre Trudeau's going to guide Canada for another few years. He does say at the time in that campaign that, you know, I won't be around. This is my last term. I'm going. And as you noted, it really wasn't spontaneous because he had talked to the Liberal Party president, Ioana Campanola, just a few days earlier and said, you know, I'm thinking about retiring. So this was on his mind. And of course, the polls were telling him Canadians really didn't want him around anymore.
Yeah, I mean, if there's any parallels between dad and son, it's that it's the moment in time as we roll into a February 29th that the polling isn't so good. We'll talk about that in a second. He had quite a consequential final 4 years, though, didn't he?
He did indeed. You know, now is the third longest serving Canadian prime minister. But more than that, he was a pivotal prime minister. You know, he really made a difference to the country. If he had gone in 1979, most of his vision that he had when he came in 1968, you know, would not have been fulfilled. And we talk, of course, particularly of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and patriation of the Canadian Constitution, which Canadian prime ministers have been trying to do since really the 1920s.
Yeah, and the National Energy Program for listeners out west. They may remember that from 1980 as well.
Right. You know, it's interesting that, you know, the students that I teach, you know, they were all born, even when Pierre Trudeau was dying. And and yet they know from their parents, I mean, in Saskatchewan, in the west, you know, they know from their parents the evil that Mr. Trudeau did when he told the farmers, why should I sell your wheat, the National Energy Program. You know, the problems that he encountered with Premier Blakeney in Saskatchewan with telecommunications. So not exactly a well-loved individual in Western Canada.
No, certainly not. I mean, that's an interesting thing about his legacy, too, is just the how polarizing his legacy can be. Because, of course, growing up in Montreal, people I grew up with, he was kind of a legend, right? And then as a young kid, I went out and lived out west for a while in Edmonton, went to grade school out there. And you didn't talk about Pierre Trudeau in Edmonton in 1980, ever. That was sort of what I had come to. And, you know, there were certainly no tears when he decided to resign, 40 years ago tomorrow.
You know, that is absolutely true. And it may be in part, you know, because the Charter is so important to Canadians and so essential to our sense of identity and who we are. But also, of course, you know, his son became, prime minister or is prime minister. You know, he married a, you know, very young woman at the time. I think they started dating when she was 18 or 19. He was late 40s. And they married, and almost a 30-year age difference. Margaret stayed around, was very much in the media. And as people said about Mr. Trudeau, unfortunately, one of his sons died in a skiing accident. But he had two children born on Christmas Day. And the joke was around Canada that, you know, God, Christ can only do it once. And Pierre Trudeau did it twice to have two kids on Christmas Day. So what a remarkable individual he was outside of the political arena.
Yeah, a flair for the dramatic. So your estimation, and I think this is pretty well documented, the whole idea of resigning on February 29th probably was not something he just dreamt up on the evening of the 28th while slogging through the snowy streets of the capital.
It was not. But, you know, it really did help to create this politician who was cut from a different mold. He was cut from a different cloth than any others, you know, whether it was Lester Pearson, the bold tie, whether it's John Diefenbaker, you know, later on, you know, John Turner or Gretchen or Mulroney. He was certainly charismatic. He dated, you know, movie stars. He was, you know, independently wealthy. He didn't seem to hold respect for anything. You mentioned the pirouette. But everything was sort of very much planned to be a non-politician. But he certainly earned respect, even though many Canadians didn't like him very much. And they were certainly glad to see him go in his party, of course, in the election when Mulroney came in September 1984. Really was a referendum on Trudeau, and it didn't go well for the Liberals, as you know, in that election.
It was clear to me that Mr. Trudeau was by far the best in the Liberal Party. To lead that party, he's very much head and shoulders above anyone else. It occurred to me unlikely that he would want to step down in favor of someone perhaps less talented.
That was Brian Mulroney, then opposition leader for the Conservatives back in 1984, reacting to news that Pierre Trudeau had announced his resignation 40 years ago tomorrow on February 29th, 1984, perhaps the most famous political event on a leap day in Canadian history. Raymond Blake is a professor with the Department of History at the University of Regina. He's written a really interesting article in The Conversation called 40 Years After His Famous Walk in the Snow, A Look Back at Pierre Trudeau's Resignation. Raymond, I was looking today at what the polling numbers were back in 1984 for Pierre Trudeau's Liberals, and they were strikingly similar to what the polling numbers are right now. Now, there's a few different equations, there's a few different factors in, such as the Bloc Québécois, but still, it was the parallels between the walk in the snow of 1984 and the position the Liberal Party found themselves under a Trudeau prime minister is strangely similar to what we're seeing today.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, tell me it's unfair in some ways to compare, you know, Justin to his father. Mm-hmm. But, you know, very few politicians know when to leave. And in Canadian history, there's only been, two or three examples of where a prime minister has resigned, passed the party to someone else, and that party then went on to continue to win the next election and probably one or two after. And most prime ministers stay till they've worn out their welcome and they get turfed out rather than leaving on their own. And so certainly Mr. Trudeau Jr. finds himself in the same situation as you pointed out, his father. Both of them now are very low in the polls. Both of them, apparently within the party, people are saying you need to go for the good of the party. And the decision, of course, rests with that individual. And I suspect, yes, as you said, there'll be no walk in the snow tomorrow. But certainly Mr. Trudeau, Justin, must be thinking about, you know, can he win an election when the polls are really quite supportive of the Conservatives? And it looks like Mr. Trudeau will find it very, very difficult to turn things around.
Yeah. Brian Mulroney made an interesting point, I thought, back in 1984 about the quality of Trudeau, Pierre Trudeau, as Liberal leader, and how he thought there wasn't really a replacement. Now, that could have just been politics. I don't know whether Brian knew he was about to win 211 seats, which is still a record, I think. But the Liberals were going to get shellacked in that next election in 1984. But it's an interesting point that he raises there, because that issue has come up around Justin Trudeau as well. I mean, if not him, then who?
No, absolutely. And, you know, you got to wonder, you know, even when Pierre Trudeau resigned because the numbers were poor in the polls, his insiders were saying, and his pollsters were telling him, look, we're doing better in January than we were doing in the previous December. And you know, I think it's turned around here. I think we can win again. And so people close to the leader sometimes, you know, we'll say, oh, we can win. And you have to wonder whether or not, you know, people within Justin's party are saying, you know, hey, it's going to get better. They're going to see through, you know, Mr. Poilievre, and they'll come back to us. They've done it, you know, in three elections, and they'll do it again. And whether or not then Mr. Trudeau believes that he can actually win, because he seems one of the things that's obvious about him, probably a bit like his father, he seems to value no opinion greater than his own. And, And so he may think he can win. He may think, hey, the Canadians love me. And for a politician to realize they don't, it must be rather disheartening.
One would think. There's an age difference, too. I mean, keep in mind, when Pierre Trudeau walked out the door, he was 65. And Justin Trudeau, I think, right now is 50, must be 52, 53. So there is that difference in wisdom and so on. I mean, at some point, I think Pierre Elliott Trudeau had decided that he had achieved what he wanted to achieve, and he didn't feel like losing yet another election because he'd already lost one in 1979. So I guess there are some differences there. I'd be very surprised. And I know this has been sort of driven just because of the parallels. I mean, and let's be frank, Justin Trudeau probably wouldn't be prime minister if he wasn't Trudeau, right? I mean, let's be frank about that. But if the people drawing these parallels as we come up to this anniversary now of saying, well, you know, wouldn't it be just so Trudeau-esque for him to walk out the door on the 29th as well?
You know, I he probably won't, because it would be, you know, it would sort of minimize, any sort of cachet with you did what Dad did. And I think it would belittle him rather than sort of elevate him in any way. And because Trudeau, Justin Trudeau, you know, to his credit, has done some very good policy initiatives, you know, whether PharmaCare, which is just coming in, daycare, the carbon tax. I know certain parts of the country don't like it, but you know, there's been a gender balance cabinet and a variety of other things. But you know, he hasn't changed the country in a way that his father did. You know, those prime ministers like Mr. Trudeau, Pierre Trudeau, they don't come along very often, and even when they go, people still didn't vote for them, but they liked them. They respected them in a way because of the integrity, because of the intelligence, because of principle. And I don't think Justin Trudeau has those attributes. I think there was a real dislike across the country for him that's almost visceral, whereas people would say, I'm not going to vote for Pierre Trudeau, but yet there was some grudging respect for him, probably what Mr. Mulroney captured in that quote that you played.
Yeah. Well, Raymond, I guess we'll all just kick back and see what happens tomorrow. As you point out, I mean, it's excessively unlikely that history will repeat itself, but it is fun to talk about. Thanks so much for your time tonight.
Well, thank you, and you have a great rest of the evening.
You know, a few years ago, just sort of in the middle of the pandemic, my dad, their dog died, Charlie. And it was, my dad's, they've had many, many pets over the years, and this one really hit him hard. So it was through those eyes that I was watching Jon Stewart on Monday, and this clip went all over social media, give a very tearful and heartfelt tribute and send-off to his dog, a dog called Dipper that they'd had for about 10 to 12 years, a brindle pit bull that they had adopted. He had been hit by a car and lost a leg. They brought him home. And it was so obvious that Stewart, who, let's be honest, I mean, he's best known for being a really cutting political satirist. And on the show on Monday, he just melted, right? And you could tell why that was, because I think all of us can identify, or many of us can identify, with the grief and pain of losing a pet. And certainly in the immediate aftermath, as it was. A reminder, you know, he started this story talking about how Dipper came to be their dog. And then he spoke about the dog passing away the day before.
Dipper passed away yesterday. He was ready. He was tired. But I wasn't. And the family, we were all together. Thank goodness we were all with him. But boy, my wish for you is one day you find that dog, that one dog. It just is the best.
Jon Stewart, needless to say, there's been a lot of reaction to what he said and a lot of an outpouring of sort of shared sympathy with what he's going through. And I thought about those out there who, you know, there's actually a whole system out there to help people cope with grief after you lose a pet, what are you supposed to do, and so on. Not just when you lose a pet, but also through veterinary care and end of life and so on. And I was really curious as to what that looks like. What are the right ways to grieve a pet? Is there even a right way to grieve the loss of a pet? Sarah Bernardi is a veterinary social worker at the Ontario Veterinary College Health Sciences Center at the University of Guelph, and she's with me now. Sarah, thanks for your time tonight.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Ben.
I guess just your reaction to that John Stewart video, because I think it spoke to, I mean, regardless of your politics, I guess, in the U.S., but it spoke to a lot of us, right? I think all of us have suffered and grieved the loss of a companion, and it was certainly a touching moment.
It was a really beautiful moment, and I think so relatable and such a raw moment. It was nice to see that, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. He's funny. The one line of his that really stood out to me, because I think this is sort of how everyone experiences the loss of a pet, is he was ready and I wasn't, as he talks about his dog Dipper, right?
Oh, yeah. That's so well said. And I feel like just a really, I mean, spot on statement, right? That's, I think, a lot of times how we feel.
How does that play out then for you? And maybe perhaps explain what it is that you do, because you do, you are in some senses, part of what you do is help those who are grieving the loss of a companion.
Oh, yeah, totally. So, well, I guess just to kind of give you the Cliff Notes version a little bit. So I work full time at the Ontario Vet College at the University of Guelph. And really, my job is very client facing in that I support the clients of OVC, so our pet parents, if you will, as they walk through treatment with their animals, their companion animals, and even in grief. So after they pass away, I also support them. So in a sense, anything before death, so treatment like during their time at the hospital, I can provide sort of emotional support, discussions around quality of life and end of life, and even help them communicate their needs with our veterinary staff. So I'm very much here to support the human components of veterinary medicine, and also in a larger sense, the human-animal bond. And the way that looks after death is I do grief counseling services for our clients, so that, you know, they have somebody to talk to and support them through their loss.
Yeah, is that relatively new to have that sort of service available for those who are going through not just both medical treatment or veterinary treatment as well as loss?
That's a really good question. So in a way, yes, I would say it's still pretty niche. It's actually vet social work as a discipline has actually probably been around, ooh, I don't know, the past 30, maybe 40 years. One of the, I guess, sort of the origin of this profession and introducing like social services and mental health support into environments like veterinary hospitals actually started at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. They have a big vet program, and there was a social worker out of that school, Dr. Elizabeth Strand, who saw the need actually for support for our veterinary professionals, and that kind of morphed into this bigger thing of how do we support the human-animal bond, and how do we, you know, recognize that our animals are actually a part of family systems. In the more recent sense, I would say. So I've actually been doing this since 2017. I was at a different hospital in downtown Toronto for 3 years doing this. But ever since the pandemic, the growth of this field, and I don't know if that's because so many people brought animals into their home during the pandemic, but the growth of this field has like just been exponential. So we're seeing a lot more people occupying these spaces, mainly in the United States, but certainly in Canada and actually internationally as well. So it's getting bigger, but yeah, it's relatively new as far as social work professions go.
Tell me a bit about what sort of the people who come to see you, what it is. I mean, I suppose it's people from all walks of life suffering through all senses of loss, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the demographic I see is pretty huge, you know, anywhere from people with children, all the way to, you know, more elderly folks, and all of them have different understandings of grief and loss. Some of them, it's their first companion animal they've lost or that they have, and some have lost many before, but this one is their heart animal, so to speak, the one that has been really tough. So I see people at all kind of different levels of their experience with pet loss and pet illness. You know, I mentioned earlier that I do a lot of conversations actually before death around quality of life and end of life, because euthanasia is obviously a really big part of veterinary medicine. It's a newer concept of medically assisted death in human medicine, but, you know, we've always talked about it in vet med. So I actually do a lot of work around helping people understand that, why it's an option, and, you know, if it's an option for them, how to kind of walk them and their families through it. So a lot of the before work and as well as after, just, you know, dealing with the loss and where it leaves people.
maybe what are some of the factors that play into the depth of that sense of loss? Because, you know, I know even within my own family, there have been times where a pet has passed and a companion has passed and it's been difficult. And there are other times where it's been truly heartbreaking. And it's been, you know, I think my father lost a pet not long ago, and the depth of his grief was to me surprising. I mean, he's a bit older now. I think he spent a lot of time with this particular dog. They were really close. You know, there are a lot of things I think that play into the depth of the sense of loss.
Yeah, it's so true. So I would say, I mean, context is everything. And I think that's true for any loss. Grief is such a unique and personal experience. And I often find that grief really mirrors the relationship that we had, right? So for people and their companion animals, you know, there's a number of different factors. I guess I will say this just to speak more generally to it and about some of the things that I see a lot and why this loss kind of runs so deep for people, so to speak. One of the big things to know about the loss of a pet is that it falls under something we actually call a disenfranchised grief. So, you know, that means a grief that's not always socially validated or understood by those around us. And it can be quite isolating in that sense. So, like, as an example, sometimes people hear things like, oh, you know, well, it was just a dog. Can't you get another? Or I can't believe you know, spend all that money on your dog's healthcare, or it's been a week. Why are you still upset about it? Right. So sometimes we find that the social circle around us doesn't always understand why we're so heartbroken. And as a result, we don't always understand why we're so heartbroken. So that's actually a really huge piece of what I deal with. I'd say that's like a pretty massive factor.
Right. Trying to validate the grief, right? Trying to explain that you do understand what it is the person's going through.
Oh, validating is everything. Yeah. I mean, it is. It's a big, big piece of what I do. And just, you know, letting people know that it's okay to feel as sad as you do. I mean, when you think about the human-animal bond, something that's so different about it than the way we bond with other people is that it's one of the only relationships we characterize as very unconditional and unspoken. So here you are, you know, having a deep, meaningful relationship with a species that's, you know, not human and doesn't even speak our language, yet we seem to know them so well and they know us. It's a very intuitive bond. And, you know, not everybody always understands that, but it certainly doesn't mean it's any less of a loss than any other type of death or grief.
Sarah Bernardi is with us. She's a veterinary social worker with the University of Guelph. We're talking about bereavement and pets, bereavement and companions. You may have seen John Stewart's video from this week on Monday. He closed out his daily show on Monday by talking about the loss of his dog, Dipper. They had adopted 12, 13 years ago. And it was Dipper's time. He said he was tired. And the words he used was Dipper was ready and I wasn't. Sarah, there must be ways of approaching the grief. And I suppose burying it or ignoring it or pretending it's not happening is probably one thing you don't want to do. And that's true of all grief. But what are some of the healthy ways to try to cope with what can be a really devastating loss?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the first thing to know, and once again, this applies to every grief, is that grief is not a problem to be fixed or solved. You know, I don't know that we ever stop grieving the beings that we love, and that includes our companion animals. Of course, we'd always rather have them with us as opposed to not. But some of the ways that you can learn to walk through this grief includes, I mean, something we actually talked about earlier, validation, mm-hmm. I think is actually a really important piece of this. So, you know, surrounding yourself with the people that, you know, have an understanding and won't judge you or invalidate those feelings of loss can be really important. So in other words, having a support circle. And I think generally we actually find that support a lot in people who have actually gone through a similar loss that we have, right? Maybe they have lost an animal before, or they do have their own pet now. So, you know, surrounding yourself with support. I also think that, you know, to kind of piggyback off that point, talked a little bit about validation and sharing stories. You know, I think honoring memories is a really important piece of this. For a lot of people, a lot of healing comes with, memorialization, right? So whether it's holding a little celebration of life, but finding ways to acknowledge that grief is real and it's valid.
Right. I guess John Stewart did that by paying tribute to his dog on his show, right? I mean, that was essentially exactly what he was doing.
I mean, yeah, that was actually huge. And it was a really great example of, you know, somebody who really put their authentic feelings out there in such a public eye. And I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people felt comfort from that, because once again, if we go back to that idea that this grief is disenfranchised, you know, our social circles are a little smaller, we're feeling a little more isolated, you know, sharing experiences can be a really important, you know, I guess, safe space for people.
Right. Is there anything that you recommend that people do? I know you deal with people too who have animals going through veterinary care. Is there anything that people can do to sort of, I don't want to use the word brace themselves, but you know, sometimes you know when a pet that you have is getting older and you can sort of see the end is coming. And I know how difficult that is. And sometimes it's just easier to ignore, but is there anything you should do in advance to sort of prepare yourself for the loss?
I mean, yeah, I think as much as you can prepare yourself, recognize that it's always going to be hard. You know, it's never easy to say goodbye. What I suggest to people is recognizing a couple things. One is that anticipatory grief is a very real thing. So the idea that we kind of feel like we're going through the motions of grief before a death even happens. So just, you know, being aware of those feelings. The other piece is, I talked a little bit about earlier how one of the kind of unique pieces of vet med is that euthanasia is often a big part of the mm-hmm. conversation. So if you are unfamiliar with euthanasia or end of life and palliative care when it comes to animals, you know, open up that conversation with your veterinary professional, even if you're not there yet. I know it can feel a little bit morbid to talk about these things, but if we kind of have a general plan about how we want to say goodbye, what we can expect from that process, it does take one more thing off of our plates when we maybe get to that point.
Yeah. And oftentimes, and you've mentioned it already, people who don't quite understand the grief or who don't quite identify with the grief will say, well, just get a new pet, like get another one, right? I suppose for each individual, that decision depends on time and when it feels right.
Absolutely. It's so unique to everyone. I mean, I see, you know, different people doing different things all the time. I just like to give sort of this general guidance out there. If you're confused or unsure about what the right time is to get you know, another companion animal, just recognize this, right? The act of bringing another animal into your home is not about replacing the one that you had, right? We all know that they have their own personalities. You know, each companion we have is unique and we will never forget them. And there's only ever going to be one of them. So I don't look at it as replacing ever, but rather you have a lot of love to give. And if you and your household are feeling ready, then that means you're ready.
Sarah, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Ben. I appreciate it.
As I was mentioning, this is something that had been speculated about and talked about for years now. And finally today, newly released documents pointed some light at what exactly happened to two scientists, a husband and wife, Chinese scientists, at a high security laboratory in Winnipeg. They were escorted out in 2019 and then fired in 2021. Well, today, it turns out that after security reviews found they had failed to protect sensitive assets and information, that's why all that happened, that ensued. So there are more than 600 pages made public today after a special all-party review of the records. Health Minister Mark Holland says the documents reveal a lack of adherence to security protocols at the lab under the Public Health Agency of Canada.
And I can tell you that in my read of the documents, and I think back to 2019, that there was the lax adherence was concerning, but that it was on the aggregate, when you take a look at it, professionals who, yes, could have and should have done better, but I don't think it rises to the point of being of firing them.
Right. So what did they do? Qingguo Qiu and her husband, Kedeng Cheng, again, were escorted out of Winnipeg's National Microbiology Laboratory in July 2019, fired in January 2021. Now, just to put this into context, that lab is Canada's only level 4 laboratory designed to deal safely with deadly contagious germs such as the Ebola virus, which Dr. Qiu had worked with. It turns out that both of them had provided confidential scientific information to China and were fired because there was a realistic and credible threat to Canada's economic security. security. They'd also engaged in clandestine meetings with Chinese officials, that all according to documents tabled in the House of Commons today. And the CSIS investigators concluded that Chiu's overriding faith in the good intentions of other scientists made her susceptible to the influence or to influence by a foreign state that could result in information or materials leaving the laboratory that could harm national security or the health of individuals. So we get a better idea that, you know, there was fire where we saw smoke, but we just got a clearer idea of what happened today. Health Minister Mark Collins says national secrets were not compromised.
At no time did national secrets or did information that threatened the security of Canada leave or enter the lab.
One of the big questions here all along, though, is why weren't they just up front with this from the get-go? Because what's happened in the interim, and nature abhors a vacuum, is that all kinds of speculation has come into play since this unfolded in 2019, then again in 2021. So why not just release this information? Because there are all sorts of excuses as to why they wouldn't do it. And once the information was released, redacted obviously in parts, it's pretty straightforward stuff. Someone who's been following this story from the get-go, even earlier, is Justin Ling. He's a freelance investigative journalist. You can find his work on Substack at the Bug Eyed and Shameless newsletter. It's excellent. Justin, thank you for your time. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
There was certainly a lot of speculation surrounding what these documents might contain. You've looked into the story a lot. What did we learn today?
We learned a lot. We learned what the actual basis of the complaint was, which has been so long coming. Like, just to give you a sense of this, I have been working on this story now for upwards of 5 years, since before COVID-19 even hit, since before these two scientists were even, I was working on their work before they were actually removed from the lab. So I have been actually fixated on what's actually been going on here for years now. And the government has been, and the government at CSIS and the Public Health Agency and the National Microbiology Lab in Winnipeg, they have all been secretive, on the border of deceptive, about what's actually happened here. And now that we finally have all of the documents in front of us, now that we actually have the full explanation of what happened, it's infuriating that they could not have told this to us 4 years ago, even 3 years ago, 2 years ago, that it took this long and this much fighting to get just basic questions answered about what happened should make us really honestly angry and should make us question why the government seems so unwilling to trust us with basic information like this.
I mean, because there were any number, and you've listed them in articles, there have been any number of reasons put forth that they simply couldn't talk about this, right? It was privacy, it was security, I mean, it was any number of things. And here we actually have the explanation. So why would they have held on to this for so long without sharing it? Because at the same time, it sort of, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. So in came the speculation. And we've sort of been treated to many years now of this kind of huge story without ever really knowing what had happened.
Yeah, so obviously we're getting to the details of what this actually went down in a second, but you know, all we knew for years was that these two scientists, both of whom worked at probably the most prestigious government-run lab in the country, they were escorted out of the lab by the RCMP. We knew there were questions swirling about some of their research students who came from China. We knew there was questions about their connections to Chinese researchers, including a Chinese research lab linked to the People's Liberation Army, the main military force in China. We knew there was questions about shipments of Ebola. And that was kind of it. There was just questions. There was no actual accusations on the table. For years, the government has sort of intoned that criminal charges could be coming. We actually didn't even know if they were fired from their jobs for quite some time. We know now, looking through these documents, that criminal charges were never really on the table, and there was no grounds for them, as best I can tell. We know that they were removed from their jobs and went through a grievance, a union-led process that ended in 2020, and that this case has been largely shut since then. If I had to tell you why the government was so secretive about this, it probably had nothing to do with these two researchers. It probably had nothing to do with the process itself. I can tell you that probably the biggest thing is that they didn't want to contribute to conspiracy theories around the origins of COVID-19, because there are a couple mentions in these documents. There's a couple references in here to some of the work being done at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, where some people believe COVID-19 emerged from. I can tell you that reading through these documents, nothing in here lends any credence to the idea that COVID-19 was a lab leak or that it was intentionally designed. You can believe those theories all you want, but nothing in these documents should contribute to your belief in that theory whatsoever. So I think it was probably a case of, frankly, a paternalistic attitude of what the public can handle in terms of the truth. And I think that probably fed to this kind of resistance to releasing them. But now that we've finally gone through the process, the appropriate things have been redacted because, you know, for privacy, for national security reasons, some things had to be redacted. But now that we have all the documents, it's really frustrating that the government wouldn't trust the public, wouldn't trust journalists, wouldn't trust parliament with these documents until now, until all of this litigation, all of this fighting, all of these political compromises had to happen.
So ultimately, why did Dr. Chinguo Qiu and Kedling Chang, why were they escorted out by the RCMP back in July of 2019?
Yeah, so it's a long saga with right. a lot of training accusations, but the long and short of it is they were originally removed because there were concerns about some of their visitors who had been brought into the lab and who were allowed to kind of move about. There were concerns about material being physically removed from the lab. There were concerns about security protocols not being followed. There were concerns about potentially intellectual property being transferred out of the country. And what's interesting is that in the initial investigation, a lot of those accusations, a lot of those allegations didn't end up being borne out. Some of them did, but by and large, there was an initial administrative investigation that found that actually in one case, there were vials being removed that led to some concern. In fact, they were empty vials. They were clean. Someone just needed some extra vials in another part of the lab and they were being removed for totally innocuous purposes. So there was a whole bunch of this smoke that turned out to be nothing, right? But then when the investigation kind of continues on as it does, CSIS gets involved and CSIS starts probing the idea that both of these researchers, but in particular, Dr. Chu, had connections to research facilities in China that may have gone into the realm of inappropriate. And over the course of an initial investigation, Dr. Chu basically denies most of those connections, basically says that, you know, there is a collaboration that goes on between her and at least two different labs in China, but all of that collaboration is above board. All of it is signed off on. She sort of admits that she's not great at following every letter of the law, right? In terms of the rules that govern how she's supposed to operate in this lab. She doesn't like paperwork. She considers some of these regulations superfluous and a hindrance to her scientific work. I think it's pretty clear that she's concerned about biosafety and biosecurity. It's not like she's totally reckless. But when it comes to paperwork, intellectual property, it's not really her thing. And again, I can tell you that that is something that came up in multiple interviews with her former colleagues. So anyway, she does this interview, but CSIS keeps digging. And what they discover is more in-depth connections than she initially let on. They find that she has personal connections to several kind of researchers that do kind of dual use work, which means that they do work that is sort of in the public health realm, but that could also have a military application. They discover that she has a bank account in China that she didn't disclose. They discover that some of the researchers who work for her and Dr. Cheng actually had connections to that military-linked lab as well. And when they go back to her and sort of put all of these things in front of her, she sort of dances around a bit. She obfuscates a little bit. She admits to some of it. She sort of tries to explain away other bits. And in this whole kind of unfurling, it just becomes really clear that the connection between these two researchers and their Chinese counterparts is much more in depth than they let on. And while some of the research was signed off on and reported to the public health agency and the National Microbiology Lab where they worked, much of it wasn't. You know, they did trips to the Wuhan Institute of Virology without disclosing it to those who will undoubtedly see evidence that this is part of a plot to create a bioweapon. She was actually, or, you know, that led to a lab leak. She was actually giving biosafety and biosecurity seminars, teaching these her Chinese counterparts how to do better, how to improve biosafety and biosecurity in that lab. I thought that was interesting. But nevertheless, you know, she was doing a lot of this collaboration without disclosing it. And it looked like she was set up, whether or not she actually received it or whether it was still hypothetical, to receive grant money from the Chinese government for her work, and that she may have done actual, you know, physical collaborations, whether in person or remotely, with several Chinese universities. So all of this to say, in the context where we are now, with Canada's relationship with China and with the concerns about their effort to steal intellectual property and to co-opt talent in Canada, CSIS made the recommendation to remove their security clearance, and the Public Health Agency of Canada told them that their security clearance was contingent on them having a job, or their job was contingent on them having security clearance, and fired them in 2020. And that's basically the story.
That's it.
And
yeah.
And all of this sort of speculation, all these accusations that have flung around have been largely disconnected from these facts. These are the facts that are on the table, but I'm really glad that this is finally out there. This is finally on the table, that we know what we're talking about now, so we can have a real conversation instead of sort of shadow boxing all of these theories.
Justin Ling is a freelance investigative journalist. You can find his work at the Bug-Eyed and Shameless newsletter on Substack. We're talking about the ongoing saga of these two Chinese scientists who were removed by the RCMP from Winnipeg's highly secretive National Microbiology Lab in July of 2019, then fired in 2021. Today, it was revealed through documents that had been talked about and speculated about for years now that they were fired after security reviews found that they had failed to protect sensitive assets and information, that Dr. Chiang Guo Chio's connections to China were perhaps far closer than she had ever admitted or ever let on. Justin, I guess the moral here is that obviously they were working within a very secretive or very high security environment at a time when Canada's relationship with China was changing very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a conversation to be had about the actual damage that they're alleged to have done, which we can talk about in a second. But I don't think in this conversation we've ever focused on the benefit they were providing, right? Because the benefit they were providing was actually being recognized by their bosses and by the federal government, right? You know, think back to before the two Michaels were arrested. The Canadian government was actually prioritizing research collaboration with the Chinese government, including with labs that may have had links or affiliations with the People's Liberation Army. The Canadian government thought of it as a benefit that we had Chinese Canadians who had strong ties in China, because the Canadian government, at a time when Donald Trump was leading the US and Europe was in sort of disarray, Canada considered it a priority to deepen relations with China in order to take advantage of the sort of rising second global power. Researchers like Dr. Chu were a part of that strategy. It was considered a net positive that she was doing this work. You know, I have the emails. I think many of the emails are included in this document that were published to the House of Commons. I have emails where Dr. Chu is talking about shipments of viruses that are going to be sent back and forth between the lab in China and the lab in Winnipeg. And her bosses were excited about this because it meant deepening collaboration with labs that were doing cutting edge research that had more money than the Canadian labs did, right? So that was the reality we were at then. Now, you can say that was naive, and you'd be right. You know, I've written in the past about how there was this sort of toxic optimism that was plaguing the Canadian government at the time. The Canadian government didn't want to accept that the Chinese government doesn't care about collaboration. It cares much more about information extraction, right? You know, there was a lot of really good warnings, some of them coming from CSIS, that Beijing was really interested not in forging partnerships with Chinese Canadians, but actually using them as sources of information to exfiltrate proprietary information from Canada. And the Canadian government didn't care, right? They were blithe to that threat. It wasn't until the abduction of the two Michaels that a light switch flipped and suddenly the Canadian government was alive to all these concerns. And that bleeds through in this investigation. I think if the two Michaels had never, you know, let's imagine a different reality where the two Michaels had never been abducted, but things had gone differently, and where Canada was still trying to deepen relations with China. Would Dr. Chu and Dr. Chang have been vilified? Would they have been removed from their jobs? Would their clearance have been revoked in that world? I'm not positive they would have. I certainly there are things here that are beyond the pale, but there are things here I think that actually could have been fixed by maybe a probationary period, by a stern talking to, by better oversight. I don't think that's impossible. If you actually look, because there's parts here where there are interviews with the two doctors, there are emails sent by the two doctors back to the investigators, and they keep underlining, we didn't have training on this stuff. We were never warned about these things. Both of them said, listen, we love Canada. We don't want to work for the Chinese government, right? We thought we were doing something good for humanity. We thought we were working with like-minded scientists, yes, in a different country, but we didn't care about the politics of it. It never enters our mind. Right. At one point, Dr. Chu basically says, I had to learn what the acronym NATO meant recently, right? So there's a level of naivety here on their part. There is a level of naivete on the Canadian government's part, but there's a level of moving the goalposts, I think, at least from the perspective of these two researchers, where they feel like they were fulfilling a mission they were given by their bosses, by the government, and the mission changed very suddenly and very abruptly, and they were caught in the lurch. And I think there's kind of something tragic about that, but there's also something tragic about the naivete that governed the Trudeau administration over those years as well.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't care about the politics, but all of a sudden the politics cared a lot about them. Justin, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
U.S. President Joe Biden, by the way, underwent his annual physical today. Apparently, he's in pretty good shape. It comes a day after, though, a gut check for the president in the Michigan primary yesterday. As the incumbent, there is virtually no challenge to Biden once again becoming the Democratic nominee for president in November. It looks very likely or almost obvious that Donald Trump will be his opponent yet again. But Michigan threw up a problem that could come back to haunt Biden in one of the key swing states that will be up for grabs in 8 months' time. He received 81% support, but more than 100,000 voters, or 13%, chose something called uncommitted. The opposition came over the president's support for Israel and made clear that he faces a pretty big battle for his own coalition and political base that he must win if he's to defeat the likely Republican nominee Donald Trump in November. Again, the voter uprising was rooted largely but not exclusively among Arab Americans. Michigan has the largest Arab American population in America. To the president's approach to the Gaza war, they want an immediate ceasefire in the region. And they're not happy with what they're seeing from the White House as far as its approach to Gaza has been so far. Joining me now is David Duilio. He's a distinguished professor of political science and director of the Center for Civic Engagement at Oakland University in Michigan. David, thanks for your time tonight.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
So a lot of eyes, I mean, there was no doubt that Joe Biden was going to win this handedly, but a lot of eyes on the uncommitteds and a campaign to try to get as many people to cast a protest vote on the Democratic side. What was your assessment of how it all wound up yesterday?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. I think I'm struggling because it's kind of a meh.
Right.
I mean, And I know that that's probably unsatisfactory, but that's or disappointing. But I think that's the real outcome, right? I mean, the folks that are downplaying this result are focused on the fact that uncommitted only got 13%, right? 13.5%, right? Which isn't out of line with what Barack Obama got in 2012, or I should say what was cast against Barack Obama in 2012 when he was running for re-election. And at the same time, you know, you look at the 100,000 vote number, and that to me seems pretty significant. That's a lot of people coming out and saying, no, Mr. President, we don't like your policy in this Israel-Hamas war. And you know, the two camps of reactions here in the States in the aftermath seem to be those who are saying, 13%, no big deal. Biden can go on as he has been. And then there's those that are saying, mainly from the right, you know, that, oh, Biden's done. Well, neither of those is correct, right? I mean, it's somewhere in the middle. It's something that the Biden campaign, I think, needs to pay attention to simply because of The fact that Michigan is the state that is so electorally competitive at the presidential level, it has been the last two times around. And it's not this one constituency that can sink a Biden bid in Michigan, but this one combined with a couple others, and he's in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, if we were talking about California, we wouldn't be having this conversation, right? I mean, it's just the margins are so slim. There are so few truly competitive states out there. Michigan is one of them. I mean, I think Trump won by 10,000, but Biden won by about 115. So if you're talking about 100,000 voters who may or may not have voted Democrat last time saying, we don't like your policies and we're thinking twice about this, that would raise some red flags, I would think.
It sure would seem so to me as well. And again, it's not that these 100,000 people are going to automatically flip and go to Trump, right? That's unrealistic.
Yeah, unlikely. Yeah.
But, you know, if a third of them decide to stay home and not vote at all, well, that's almost as bad as a vote for Trump, right? And that's where you get into the combination of factors that are dangerous territory for the White House, right? If you get, say, a third of those 100,000, and then, you know, if he suffers some additional losses among union workers because Trump has some strength there, and then maybe the younger voters aren't as jazzed up or as enthusiastic as they used to be about Biden, and there's 150,000 votes right there, right? I mean, yeah. It's not the math is not that hard.
It's a fragile coalition. Tell me a bit about this campaign on the uncommitted side for a Canadian audience looking. I mean, what the question one always asks when looking at it is, okay, you disagree with President Biden's policies on the war in Gaza, or at least in anything that's happened since October the 7th has been a big check mark against or a big X against the current president, but the alternative doesn't seem much more appealing if you're an Arab American in Michigan.
I think that's right, and you know the where do those voters go is the question, right? I mean, and if this is such a different issue for these folks, right? Because it is such a personal, emotional issue that, you know, it's oftentimes in the States, we hear people say that they're going to hold their nose and vote for the lesser of two evils, right? I'm not sure for these voters that exists. I mean, I'm trying to put myself in their shoes, and I obviously can't, but, you know, I could see where they would say, look, I can't vote for either of these individuals. So again, maybe they stay home, maybe they try to find a third party candidate that they could support, but I think it's I think the impact of this uncommitted effort, number one, it's not going to stop. I think they got enough votes, and the folks that are behind it are committed, including Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib. Her sister has played an integral part in this. The mayor of Dearborn, right? These folks are not going away. They're going to continue this push. And I think that's the real question now moving forward, right? Is, okay, you got 100,000 votes. What is that going to mean in the future? I tend to think that they're not going to stop pressing the White House. And is that, but the question is, okay, does that lead to policy change on this issue? And I'm struggling to find a scenario where it does lead to some significant shift, frankly, just because I think President Biden is a true supporter of the state of Israel, right? And nobody wants to see the casualties and deaths that are occurring, but I think that's where he is. In addition, you know, if he did shift, he might alienate more people on the other side of that issue. And that now he's in real trouble. So, you know, he's in a bit of a pickle.
Yeah. And it's hard to see where I think this is an issue that a lot of people are having around this war. And it's certainly playing out within the Democratic Party. Where did the uncommitted was not just, obviously Michigan has a large Arab American population, but it wasn't just that. There were progressives as well. This is sort of a fight that's being played out in other parts of the country as well within the Democratic Party.
And I think that that's a really good point is in the not even day since we've had these results, the I've read some stories today saying there are some other communities or some other activists that are going to try and replicate this in upcoming primaries. And I think that that's an aggressive thing to try to do because it works here because there are leaders of that who connect with a clear constituency. You know, Michigan has got that. It's got the highest concentration of Arab American voters in the country. Maybe, you know, Minnesota has got some similar constituencies, but you know, you struggle to find a lot of votes that could replicate the results here in Michigan.
David Duilio is a distinguished professor of political science and director of the Center for Civic Engagement at Oakland University in Michigan. We're talking about the results of yesterday's primaries. A bit of a gut check for Joe Biden. He did win handedly, 81% of the vote there, but more than 100,000 people came out and voted uncommitted, just 13%. But this was seen as sort of a backlash against the White House's policies right now towards Israel and Gaza, large Arab American population, obviously the largest in Michigan. And they're not happy with the White House's policies on this war, and they want to see change. And that's where the pressure was coming from. David, on the other side, once again, I mean, I think Donald Trump had a successful night. He's obviously clearly on his way to the Republican nomination, as many had been talking about for weeks now. But he, too, has some red flags there. I mean, Nikki Haley did fairly well. Trump was below 70%, and he was below his polling numbers.
Yeah, and before we get to the GOP side, one last point about the Democratic side of this, you know, the folks that have been pushing this uncommitted vote, as you said very, very well, they're looking for this change in policy. And it's interesting to me to think about what that would look like, right? Because it's not up to Joe Biden if there's a ceasefire, right? I mean, so. You know,
yeah, that's the interesting part. I mean, they're talking, it's a single issue fight over something that's not really up to the White House, right?
Right. I mean, so even if he were to rhetorically, and he has started to do that, right? I mean, there's although it may have just fallen apart, right? There's these conversations that are happening or negotiations in Paris between some states. But again, it's not like he can snap his fingers and give them what they want. I suppose, you know, we could see a shift in the aid that Israel is getting. But even that, is that enough to give these folks what they're looking for? And I'm just not sure I see a path that makes them happy, which is just makes it even more complex and more difficult for the White House. On the Republican side, yeah, I think there's red flags for both candidates, you know, and we haven't even gotten into a number of them on the Biden side. But for Trump, you know, yeah, he cracked 60%. That's darn near 40% of Republicans who want somebody else. And, you know, just like there's divisions in the Democratic Party, on this particular issue of the Israel-Gaza war, on the Republican side, those divisions are also present, but I think they're much broader, right? I mean, I think that there's breadth to the Republican division and there's depth to this particular Democratic division. And, you know, there are clearly many, many Republicans who are interested in moving on from Donald Trump. But at the same time, his supporters are so incredibly loyal that they are excited and enthusiastic about voting for him.
I suppose when you add it all up, what we saw yesterday is a reminder that although both candidates, both leading candidates, and presumably the two who will be facing off again come November, did very well in Michigan by all comparisons yesterday, that it's going to be a tight race come November, and it's still very much a purple state.
Oh my gosh, yes. I wrote a piece a month or so ago for an outlet here in Michigan, and it was all about get ready, Michigan, because the ads are coming.
Yeah.
And we are a very competitive state electorally, 50-50. I mean, yes, you can have an outcome here or there that is by greater margins, but it's going to be a really narrow victory for whoever carries the state. And that just means that the candidates are going to be here a lot. Their surrogates are going to be here a lot. And millions upon millions of dollars are going to be spent here in Michigan. And we're about to get inundated with political ads.
David, thank you so much.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.